Iran's leader tells the Russian president that NATO is a dangerous entity that would have attacked Russia over Crimea if Moscow had not stopped it in Ukraine. The presidents of Turkey, Iran and Russia attend a tripartite summit on Syria, condemning foreign meddling and emphasizing Syrians' right to determine the country's fate. Iran says Israel's atrocities against Palestinian children amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity, whose perpetrators must be brought to justice. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says any military move in northern Syria would definitely harm Turkey, Syria, and the whole region. Ayatollah Khamenei said fighting terrorism is a must, but a military incursion into Syria will benefit terrorists alone. He also underlined the significance of Syria's territorial integrity. The leader said the problems in Syria should be resolved through negotiations. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with the visiting Turkish president. Recep Tayyip Erdogan also said that terrorist groups in Syria are supported and armed by Western countries, including the US. On Tuesday afternoon, the Iran leader also met the Russian president and discussed bilateral ties as well as regional and global issues. Ayatollah Khamenei said Tehran and Moscow need to be vigilant against, quote, deceptive policies of the West. He also stressed the need for driving U.S. forces out of oil-rich areas east of the Euphrates River in Syria. The Iranian leader described NATO as a dangerous entity which knows no limits. Ayatollah Khamenei said if Russia had not stopped NATO in Ukraine, the military alliance would have started the war in Crimea as a pretext. He also called for the de-dollarization in international trade transactions. Iran's president says the integrity and independence of Syria must be respected and a military intervention in the Arab country will only worsen the situation there. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks after a trilateral summit with his Russian and Turkish counterparts on Syria. The Iranian president said the fate of Syria must be determined by its own people and without any foreign interference. Raisi condemned the US for making illegal bases in the country and plundering Syria's natural resources. He underscored Israel's attacks against the Arab countries, saying the regime's actions threaten peace and security in the region. Russian President Vladimir Putin also made similar remarks about Syria's sovereignty.
Good steps must be taken in order to help an inclusive dialogue so that the Syrians would be able to determine their fate without external interference.
Putin said the seventh summit of the Astana process has been fruitful. Putin condemned the West for plundering Syria's natural wealth with the intention of disintegrating the country. He called on the United Nations to provide humanitarian aid to Damascus without any preconditions. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was next to deliver a speech. He called the Astana process the only platform that has taken necessary measures for peace in Syria. The peace process was launched in 2017 at the initiative of Tehran, Moscow and Ankara on how to reduce tensions in Syria. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a three-way summit on the situation in Syria within the framework of the Astana process, which seeks to end more than 11 years of conflict in the Arab country. The leaders of the three countries, as the guarantors of the Astana process, took part in the Tehran summit on Tuesday.
During a joint press conference, which followed the latest round of their Astana process talks, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi welcomed the Russian and Turkish presidents, along with their accompanying delegations, to the summit. Raisi stressed the need to protect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, as well as the importance of the fight against terrorism.
Discussions focused on the sovereignty of Syria and the territorial integrity of the country, emphasizing that the Syrian government must rule over all parts of the country and that the presence of Americans on the eastern banks of the Euphrates is not acceptable and they must withdraw and all parts of the country must be governed by the legitimate government. We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism and there is the need to do so and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region. The all-out fight against terrorism by the Islamic Republic of Iran was a successful experience. I commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani as the icon of resistance and combating terrorism. All countries have fought against terrorism, but today there are concerns about the presence of terrorists in Syria. So there is a need for firm results to be achieved by all states that participate in the fight against terrorism.
Russian President Vladimir Putin echoed similar remarks and highlighted the importance of the Astana process.
We agree.
In order to normalize the situation in Syria, all three countries have agreed that full settlement of the conflict is only possible through political means and holding talks based on UNSC Resolution 2254. And while observing the basic principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity and unity of Syria, all these principles must be respected and the future of Syria must be dictated by its own people and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
The crisis in Syria can only be resolved through political dialogue. We also discussed our future steps. We told our partners in the Astana process that political dialogue must be accelerated. The next round of talks related to the Constitutional Committee must be held and must reach a conclusion within the framework set by the UN and based on UN Security Council Resolution 2254. It must be implemented to help bring about peace and tranquility to Syria.
Political commentator Sayed Mohammad Marandi says Turkey's previous incursion into Syria took a toll on its own security.
I think the last decade has shown that Turkish policy in Syria, which was supported by NATO and oil-rich family dictatorships in the Persian Gulf, as well as the Israeli regime, this policy has failed, and it has destroyed much of Syria. It has led to chaos. It has led to the American occupation of large segments of the country, roughly a third of the country. And the Americans have been supporting terrorists in those areas in which it occupies, terrorists that also target the Turkish government. So not only are the Turks dealing with millions of refugees, but they're also dealing with terrorists supported by their so-called NATO ally. So for the Iranians, the only real solution is for Turkey to have some sort of settlement with the Syrian government. Turkey must accept Syrian sovereignty and respect the government in Damascus. They tried, they used all sorts of extremist groups, but it failed.
Iran and Russia taking a step further to a local currency market as they unveil the trading symbol of rial rub currency pair, which will help boost trade between the two countries. The governor of the Central Bank of Iran says the currency symbol will ease exchanges in the integrated forex market. Ali Saleh Abadi said the move will make an important contribution to the development of trade ties between Tehran and Moscow, particularly in the sector of the services. Saleh Abadi further explained that exporters will be able to do transactions using the new currency at an agreed rate. He said Iranian students in Russia can also benefit as they are the main applicants for ruble and will get their required currency from the market. A currency pair is the quotation of two different currencies with the value of one being quoted against the other. Iran's historic memorandum of understanding between its national oil company and Russia's energy giant Gazprom for joint investment in the energy sector. Managing director of the national Iranian oil company, Mohsen Khojastemir, and Gazprom's deputy chairman, Vitaly Markelov, signed the MOU virtually. That's just hours before Russian President Vladimir Putin landed in Tehran for a summit on Syria. Khojastemir said the document will be Iran's largest foreign investment on record. The Russian company will spend $40 billion to help develop Iran's Kish and North Pass gas fields, as well as six oil fields. It will also be involved in the construction of gas pipelines. When asked about U.S. sanctions, the Iranian official said the bans on Tehran and Moscow will make no difference in fulfilling the agreement. Iran has the world's second largest gas reserves after Russia. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations has accused Israel of crimes against humanity over what it calls systematic and flagrant violations of children's rights. Majid Takht-e-Ravanchi made the statement while addressing a UN Security Council debate on children armed conflict. He pointed to UN reports that the regime has committed nearly 3,000 violations against Palestinian children. Takht-e-Ravanchi said a UN report says that Israel has killed 90 children in 2021 alone. The Iranian ambassador to the UN said the perpetrators of such heinous crimes must be brought to justice. A group of Iranian protesters have gathered outside the Swedish embassy in order to denounce the recent ruling by the Stockholm District Court sentencing an Iranian national to life in prison. Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian deputy prosecutor, has been facing trial in Sweden over alleged rights abuses. From Tehran, Yusuf Jalari reports.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how these angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nouri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardasht prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters warned that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. This audio file of an alleged Nouri phone conversation from prison shows that he was prevented from visiting an ophthalmologist despite his worsening eye condition. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iranian national airline Iran Air has recently resumed direct flights between Tehran and Rome after a four-year suspension. Aviation ties between the two countries were severed in 2018 due to the pressures by the previous US administration, which unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA and imposed many sanctions on Iran.
Iran's flagship carrier, Iranair, has returned to Rome from July 14. A new deal recently signed between Iranian and Italian aviation authorities has revived the route connecting Tehran and Italy's capital, Rome. The deal is a revised version of previous aviation cooperation agreement, which stresses the importance of increased flights between the two countries to help boost economic ties and tourism.
Io già andai in Iran 20 anni fa.
I visited Iran 20 years ago, and I've been thrilled about that trip. I'm going again with a group of friends in September, and we're all very excited.
There has certainly been a more intense dialogue between Italy and Iran lately, and this is extremely positive. Having said that, we are still facing enormous difficulties due to the sanctions. However, we are confident that more European routes will be added by Iran Air in the future.
Iranair, which has been flying to Italy for 55 years, also operates flights to the business-focused city of Milan in the north of the country. Aviation ties between Iran and Italy took a hit in 2018 when the US unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Washington's withdrawal was followed by a wave of anti-Iran sanctions by the US.
I hope this resumption of the Tehran-Rome route will bode well for another resumption, that of the JCPOA, from which the US unilaterally withdrew in 2018. It would be really important for tourism and commerce that flight connections between Iranian and European cities are established.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Rome last week to meet his Italian counterpart and discuss the latest geopolitical developments across the globe. During that visit, Iran's top diplomat also met with tens of Italian industrialists and businessmen who showed a strong interest in cooperating with Tehran. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that's a wrap on the world news. Thanks for joining us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While fires rage and temperatures in Western Europe top the charts, the UK's Met Office announced the first ever red warning for extreme heat expected in the coming days. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading
Europe is cooking. Records smashed as historic heat alert issued. Here's the details. Several countries across Europe are enduring the dangerous hot conditions that climate scientists have long warned of, and meteorologists project the brutal heat wave could last in some areas through next month. Spain and Portugal have faced high temperatures since last Friday, July 15th. According to CNN, at least three Spanish cities set records this week. Orson at 43.2 degrees Celsius, Soria at 38.7 degrees Celsius, and Zamora at 41.1 degrees Celsius. In Portugal, the network noted, 8 out of the country's 18 mainland districts have been placed under a red weather warning by the Portuguese Institute for the Sea and Atmosphere, IPMA. Both nations plus France are also battling wildfires that have forced evacuations and destroyed thousands of acres across the region. Blazes have also hit Croatia's Adriatic Sea coast, where firefighter Boris Doric told state television that it's hell. We don't know where to go first. AccuWeather senior meteorologist Tyler Roy said recently that the European heat wave could be one of the continent's worst since 1757. There is concern that this heat could become a long-duration heat wave, 20 or more days for many locations from Portugal to central France and interior southeastern Europe, as it could last for the rest of July and continue into August, explained Roy, referring to an area that includes parts of Bosnia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Hungary, Romania, and Serbia. July all-time records are at risk of being approached, tied, or even broken across Ireland and the UK, he added. This includes individual cities such as Birmingham, Dublin, Manchester, and York. The Met Office, the UK's National Meteorological Service, on Friday, July 15th, issued its first ever red warning for high heat. Exceptional, perhaps record-breaking temperatures are likely early next week, quite widely across the red warning area, and focused a little more east and north, said Paul Gunderson, the office's chief meteorologist. He added that there is a 50% chance temperatures top 40 degrees Celsius and an 80% chance of a new maximum temperature. Nights are also likely to be exceptionally warm, especially in urban areas. This is likely to lead to widespread impacts on people and infrastructure, he continued, adding, therefore, it is important people plan for the heat and consider changing their routines. This level of heat can have adverse health effects. Nikos Christidis, a climate attribution scientist at the office, addressed how the current heat wave relates to the fossil fuel-driven global emergency. In a recent study, we found that the likelihood of extremely hot days in the UK has been increasing and will continue to do so during the course of the country, with the most extreme temperatures expected to be observed in the southeast of England. We'll be right back. Climate change has already influenced the likelihood of temperature extremes in the UK. The chances of seeing 40 degrees Celsius days in the UK could be as much as 10 times more likely in the current climate than under a natural climate unaffected by human influence. The likelihood of exceeding 40 degrees Celsius anywhere in the UK in a given year has also been rapidly increasing, and even with the current pledges on emissions reductions, such extremes could be taking place every 15 years in the climate of 2100. Reuters reported that a study in the journal Nature last week found the number of heat waves in Europe has increased 3 to 4 times faster than in the rest of northern mid-latitudes, such as the United States and Canada, due in large part to the jet stream air current splitting into two parts for longer periods. Europe is very much affected by changes in atmospheric circulation. A study co-author and Columbia University climate scientist Kai Kornhaber told the news agency, adding, "It's a heat wave hotspot." However, Europe isn't alone in enduring high temperatures. Axis pointed out that the European heat wave is hitting at the same time as record hot temperatures are affecting China, and triple-digit temperatures are testing the reliability of the Texas electrical grid. The extreme heat has led campaigners to demand that governments, particularly the rich countries disproportionately responsible for planet warming emissions, act much more urgently to tackle the climate emergency, especially by rapidly transitioning to clean energy. As the advocacy group Food and Water Watch put it recently, these record-breaking heat waves and wildlife risks could be mitigated with serious government commitments to cutting fossil fuel emissions.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, acquire knowledge when you're very young, because when you grow up, you're going to be successful and progressful for your society. In this program, we try to give you the tips. We try to give you the information how you can make your children give all that knowledge as young as possible, where you can start up with your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Akavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafza Almi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's an honor. Thank you very much.
Brother Nakavina, previous sessions, we talked about how we can help a child maintain relationship with his own self. In this session, I would want to ask you how a child can develop, maintain relationships with other human beings.
Yes, we are talking about the classification of behavior.
Yeah.
As you said, that we have talked about the relationship with oneself and all the various types of things which he has to take care of, she has to take care of as a child or as a parent who is trying to teach and educate their children about these things.
Yes.
So now we come to the point where we have to teach our child about how to maintain relationships.
Yes.
With other human beings.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the other human beings, the first thing which comes is the family.
Okay.
My relationship with my family. Okay. I have to teach him how to behave with his family, which his family means
the parents
themselves.
Yes.
How he should be able to maintain a relationship with his or her parents. That is very much the foremost thing that has to be taught. And of course, they are grandparents.
Yes.
If people have their children who have their grandparents living with them, or even if not living with them, but how to deal with their grandparents, how to love them, take care of them, how to respect them, how to maintain a good friendly relationship with them, how to take care of them. Many people have grandparents who are of age, they are sick, they are ill, and so many things. So we're just talking about the major issues that are there. Then at a detailed level, we have to go into the different the details, the intricacies of these relationships. But just to give the bigger picture, that as a parent, because we're talking about our audience are the parents.
Yes.
We're talking to the parents now.
Yeah.
And the parents should know what their scope of guidance and upbringing is. So we talked about how to manage their relationships
with self.
And now we're talking about with other human beings. And the foremost thing is the family. The relationship which a child should have with the parents themselves, the parents have to teach him or her how to deal with his or her parents.
Yes.
And that, of course, can be done by my parents are alive and my children observe how I am dealing with my parents, how I respect them, how I establish that loving relationship with them, that relationship where there's trust and there's love and there's respect. And he or she observes me taking care of my parents.
Okay.
And he or she will certainly
automatically learn that. Indeed.
Then comes the level of my siblings, my brothers and sisters. So how do I deal with my sister? How I deal with my brother?
And if they're elder to you, how do you deal with them? If they're younger than you,
so many issues are there.
Yes. So these relationship domains are important. How you manage all that is important. And how a child can develop all those skills will continue. That discussion with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how a child can manage relationship with others. And the first thing we came to know about was how he can manage relationship with his family, his parents, his mother, his father, his grandparents, his siblings. And now you're talking about other relationships.
So, yes, as we said, others, the first thing, the parents themselves, the grandparents, and then the siblings, And then one is getting prepared for marriage.
Yes.
Now he has to know how to manage his relationship with his spouse or her spouse. That is also, it has to be taught. It has to be learned in the family.
Okay, so I as a parent have to manage my behavior with my partner so that my child learns how he behaves with his spouse tomorrow.
Exactly. Of course, there are certain things which I cannot teach them. I should send my child to
a trainee, a mentor.
A pre-marital course or something like that where he learns or she learns how to engage. I mean,
how to behave with his spouse tomorrow.
I mean, unfortunately, in the beginning, there's all love, 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 and then there's quarrel, quarrel, quarrel.
Yes, yes, of course.
So how do we do that?
Because they don't have a proper knowledge about how to deal with all these relationships.
There's a slogan given one of our Iranian scholars in Persian. He says, "Aqilane izdivaj konid, ashiqane zindagi konid."
Okay, what does that mean?
It means that when you are going to get engaged and going to get married, make a proper intellectual decision.
Yeah.
Understand each other. Understand what your goals
are. Get involved intellectually. Goals. How
are you compatible? Are you compatible?
Yeah.
Before putting on this,
yes,
it's like a chain.
Yeah.
It's not going to be removed easily. So before you put on that chain,
just know that intellectually what it is. What kind of chain you're putting on.
And then live with a loving relationship.
Yeah.
But mostly we do it oppositely.
We start with love and then we try to go to the intellect. All right. So that's an important point.
I have to learn how to, for example, when I'm getting married, I know how to select my spouse.
Okay.
How to, that selection is done. And then after getting married, how we have to live together. What are the rules?
The things the fiqh rules, have to take care of.
The ethics.
Yeah.
And how to manage these relationships.
Yes.
So I have to learn that.
All right.
Mostly we start learning after
getting into a relationship.
Of course, much of that, it's natural that much of that learning comes afterwards. But you have to be prepared for that.
Yes, yes.
At least on a theoretical level.
Definitely.
And then comes our relationship with our children. I have to be able to, when my child is going to become a parent, then how to manage his or her relationship with their children.
Well, that's a turn over here. So what other relations a child has to learn? I'll talk on that note with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how a child can manage relationship with others. Mr. Nakavi, so far you said how he can manage relationship with his parents. He needs to take care of his relationship with grandparents. He needs to take care of his relationship with siblings, be that younger, be that elder. He needs to take care of their relationship with a spouse when he gets elder, when he gets grown up tomorrow. And when he becomes a parent tomorrow, how he develops a relationship with his own children. That all has to be learned from a particular age.
And that's, we were talking about the family relationship, and we were talking about the first degree relatives. These are the first degree relatives. And then we have the second degree relatives.
Of course.
A whole big family, many people have big families, huge families, aunts and uncles and cousins and so many.
Joint families, extended families,
so many things which have, we have so many relationships we have to manage.
Yes.
And then we have amongst those second-degree relatives, as I said, the blood relatives.
Yes.
And more important than when you get married, you have in-laws.
Of course.
So that's the most delicate relationship, which is, you know, which has to be maintained.
Yes. So if you're prepared at a very early age for all that, all those relationships, and when you reach that particular age of marriage, and then when you have in-laws, you don't get into trouble.
Exactly. I mean, the basic values which govern our relationships, basically the general principles are the same for every relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to say and impress upon the audience that there are so many relationships and so many difficulties. Yes, these are challenges, but certain core values, knowledge, skills are there, which are general for all.
Okay.
But then there are certain knowledge and skills which are specific for certain relationships.
Okay.
I mean, certainly the relationship which you have with your parents or your siblings is quite different from what is there with your spouse.
Okay.
So the skill, knowledge and skill set differs quite
There's vastly. A huge difference between those maintenance of relationships.
Yes.
With your siblings and your spouse and others.
Of course, and your children, and then your blood relatives, then your in-laws. So these are very delicate issues which have to be managed. And one has to be able to, one should be prepared. I mean, what are we targeting? We are targeting general competencies in human behavior.
Yeah.
We're not talking about professional competencies. We're not talking about that. It's just one aspect of our lives.
Okay.
Professional competencies, I'm becoming a doctor, I'm becoming an engineer, I'm becoming a software specialist, I'm becoming a manager.
Yeah. Well, so these were all general relationships one has to take care of, one has to learn at a very early age. And as soon as a child learns all that, he gets into developed into what we want, and maybe when he is, he's professional at this general level, he gets professional at a social level as well tomorrow. Thank you so much, Mr. Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., the day after the West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin scuttled plans to pass a climate and tax package, many in his party blamed him for the demise of their ambitions and expressed a lack of trust in him. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Emily Cochrane, Katie Edmondson, and Stephanie Lai. The piece is titled, Manchin Dangles Hopes of a Future Compromise, Democrats Revolt. Please stay with us for more. It was a familiar, if excruciating, position for Democrats. A day after pulling the plug on his party's plans to pass a climate, energy and tax package this summer, Senator Joe Manchin III of West Virginia, the conservative-leaning Democrat who has repeatedly flirted with compromise only to scuttle his party's highest ambitions, called in on Friday to a West Virginia radio show. Perhaps, he suggested, in another month or so, he might see his way clear to salvaging the last bits of President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. There was no guarantee, of course, and the comments were only the latest instance of Joe Manchin capitalizing on his role as a swing vote in an evenly divided Senate to dictate his party's legislative strategy, leaving Democrats at his mercy. This time, though, Democrats had had enough. Rather than engage in another round of will-he-or-won't-he negotiations with Mr. Manchin, President Biden let it be known that he was done trying to secure his climate agenda in Congress. Joe Manchin's abrupt withdrawal left Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and a majority leader, jilted after months of courting a colleague whose demands and red lines seemed to shift by the day, or the latest economic projection. And it prodded many Democrats into open revolt against Mr. Manchin, blaming him for the demise of their ambitions and the last chance for their party to tackle the existential threat of climate change. Joe Manchin, said Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has shown that he doesn't know how to close a deal, or he doesn't want to close a deal, and that you can't trust him. For more than a year, Joe Manchin, who at 74 is serving his third term in the Senate, has been situated exactly where he prefers to be, at the center of the high-stakes political and policy negotiation, with attention and speculation focused on him. Democrats have toiled to win his vote on any piece of their once ambitious domestic agenda, tailoring their policy moves so as not to alienate him. They have contorted themselves to suit his often changing dictates and have scaled back their ambitions repeatedly to stay within his red lines. But they have so far come away empty-handed on their biggest priorities. Because of Democrats' razor-thin margin of control in the 50-50 Senate and unified Republican opposition to most of their agenda, Joe Manchin has effective veto power over the party's legislative strategy and has exercised it often and unapologetically. But while President Biden and congressional Democrats have pushed for transformative policies to confront generational challenges such as climate change, Joe Manchin, who channels the desires of his very conservative coal and gas producing state, has focused on nearer term issues. On Friday, he said he had told party leaders he wanted to wait another month until inflation numbers for July were released before he could decide on whether to act on climate change. I am where I have been. I would not put my staff through this. I would not put myself through this if I wasn't sincere about trying to find a pathway forward to do something that's good for our country, Joe Manchin said on Friday in the interview with the radio host Hoppy Kershaval. They cannot come to grips because I have a D by my name, or someone has an R by their name. We should do whatever one side wants. That's not me. President Biden made no mention of Joe Manchin in a statement issued on Friday. Asked at a news conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, whether the West Virginian senator had been negotiating in good faith, the president demurred, saying he was not the one who had been negotiating with him. But angry congressional Democrats pinned their frustration on the West Virginia Democrat. One senator, Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, mused publicly about whether Joe Manchin deserved his chairmanship of the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. It's been a really, really terrible day, Senator Tina Smith, Democrat of Minnesota and a key champion of climate provisions, said in an interview. If Senator Manchin wants a deal on climate and energy, he can have one in a heartbeat. This is Senator Manchin's deal for the taking. And if it doesn't happen, it is on him. On Capitol Hill, Joe Manchin is something of a unicorn, the only national Democrat from his ruby-red state, and acts and votes accordingly. Set to face voters in 2024, he is unlikely to be threatened by a primary challenger in a state former President Donald Trump won by nearly 40 percentage points in 2020. That has given Mr. Manchin leverage to accomplish his own policy goals, including holding firm against moving entirely away from oil and gas, and resist what he considers his party's lurch towards its liberal base. He appears happiest when he is in the middle of a consequential policy negotiation. He has been wined and dined as a crucial participant in bipartisan talks, invited to President Biden's Wilmington home for breakfast, and pursued by the White House officials, lawmakers, aides and reporters who dissect his every syllable for a kernel of insight. But the murkiness and at times inconsistency of Joe Manchin's positions has increasingly grated on his Democratic colleagues. Barely 3 months into the Biden administration, he prompted the longest open vote in modern Senate history by raising a last-minute objection to the size of unemployment benefits in the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid plan. Democrats had to slash the jobless payments to win his vote, which cemented passage of the package. He refused to help Democrats change filibuster rules to enact voting rights legislation, killing the effort even after Chuck Schumer gave him the lead role in writing an alternative bill to ensure he would support it. But on no issue has Joe Manchin bedeviled Democrats more than on their ambitious social safety net, climate and tax package. To win his vote to begin work on the plan, Chuck Schumer signed on to a secret memo with Mr. Manchin that made clear that the West Virginian senator had no intention of accepting the $3.5 trillion in spending envisioned in Democrats' budget. The document outlined Joe Manchin's much narrower parameters for a $1.5 trillion package, including income thresholds for social programs and accommodations for fossil fuel tax credits and natural gas. "I will try to dissuade Joe on many of these," Chuck Schumer scrawled on the document, which enraged many Democrats when it became public. He never could. 6 months later, Joe Manchin abruptly walked away from talks on the package. Democrats regrouped in January and began efforts to rebuild their shattered plan, adhering strictly to the components that Joe Manchin had repeatedly laid out: paying down the national debt, overhauling parts of the tax code, and lowering the cost of prescription drugs by allowing Medicare to negotiate prices and some spending. By earlier this month, Senate Democrats had begun rolling out pieces of a package they believed could win Joe Manchin's support, including a drug pricing proposal and a plan to shore up the solvency of a key Medicare program by increasing taxes for some high-earning Americans. But by Thursday evening, 14th of July, after news that prices had surged 9.1% in the year ending in June, Joe Manchin balked again, telling Chuck Schumer that he wanted to wait on any climate or tax proposals until seeing inflation figures for the month of July. Should Democrats insist on pushing forward with legislative action before then, Joe Manchin said, they should act only on proposals aimed at lowering the cost of prescription drugs and extending expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies. Let's wait until that comes out so we know what we're going down the path it won't be inflammatory to add more to inflation, Joe Manchin said in the radio interview. Recounting Chuck Schumer's response, Joe Manchin added, I said, Chuck, it's wrong. It's not prudent to do the other right now. I want climate, I want an energy policy, he said, adding, I thought we were moving truly in the right direction. But Chuck Schumer appeared to have grown exasperated and convinced that Joe Manchin's vote was not obtainable. One official said that Joe Manchin had rebuffed major concessions that would have enraged progressive Democrats, including adding more drilling measures, removing a key electric vehicle tax credit, and dropping tax increases he had resisted. Mr. Manchin's stance effectively scuttled the chances of action in the coming days on a critical priority for Democrats and strongly suggested that unless they abandon the climate and tax proposals altogether, they might not salvage any of their domestic policy package before the midterm congressional elections in November. In September, after a five-week planned recess, lawmakers will have only a limited window to act on the package, and they're eager to give themselves as much time as possible to campaign on whatever they pass before the November elections. Bearing political scars from a year of fractious talks, few Democrats on Friday, 15th of July, seemed willing to gamble that there was a larger deal to be had in September.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.